Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Web3 Empire. In this episode, I'm talking to a very special person, the managing director of a venture capital firm called BlockRocket. I met Ben through MDX Berlin, where he gave a very impressive presentation. I respect them as a leading VC in the space. They invest into blockchain-related startups with a ticket size of up to 500k worldwide, and so far they've made 20 investments and they're growing. Obviously, I asked him on how he got into Web3 and the blockchain space and how they're helping startups to find product market fit. Then we talked about how to measure success and make good investment decisions. And in the end, we spent a few minutes on advice for founders and the current state of the market. I really enjoyed this episode so much, and thank you all for listening. Enjoy. Happy to have you on the show, Ben, of BlockRocket VC, one of the leading VC firms in early stage Web3 startups. I'm super excited to talk about everything you do, how you got into the space, and about the work you're doing at BlockRocket as well. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for inviting me, Nino. Nice to be here.
Of course. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into crypto and Web3, and what's your background?
I finished university or business school in 2016, and I've been abroad a lot, worked across like different countries in Asia and Southeast Asia specifically. I also spent in India some time. I've been mostly active on the early stage startup side as a company builder and founder myself. So I've worked for companies like Rocket Internet, where we went to Southeast Asian countries to try to like clone existing business models. So I was working for an eBay clone, for example, okay, in Cambodia for some time. I had experience in these like early stage setups through company building. Then I tried myself as a founder 2017-18. Back then I was the founder of a social app, was a friend finding app with a psychometric algorithm. That's also when I started learning to code. And a co-founder next to me, but me and him were both business people. We bootstrapped quite a lot and hustled. Like it was until like late 2017, early 2018. It didn't work out, unfortunately. So I'm very aware of the struggle and hustle that's required from being an early stage founder yourself. And I'm very aware, like statistically, it's 80% or more of business owners don't work. They don't work. So I think like startups, early stage startups is basically like best. It's like living use cases of innovation. I think that's the way I would look at the startup world. And then 2018, I started working for several consulting projects from the academic, entered from the academic angle. So I worked for Frankfurt School Blockchain Center. There's a pretty well-known professor there, Professor Zander. Worked for like various projects of his. Because of my early stage background, a startup background and venture building focus, just one thing led to another, was very active ecosystem and good network. And there's a few shareholders who met, two of them are high net worth individuals. They had pretty big exits with their own companies. They didn't come from the blockchain space. They had different businesses. They succeeded.
Okay.
And the idea was born of BlockRocket, which was basically an early investor, but technically it's an angel syndicate. So basically we had a collection of shareholders who wanted to start investing some of their money like into early stage Web3 startups, because we saw that in 2019, 2020, 2021, that the startup landscape in the Web3 space was born. Yeah. And I was hired to put a team, to assemble a team and to start making due diligence, building up a brand, building deal flow, coming up with the first investment decisions. And then we started investing in 2020. We invested in almost 20 companies so far. So it was basically 10 a year. So the deal flow massively increased. I think it doubled year by year. So the last 12 months, we have screened more than 1,000 companies and ended up investing in 10. We're not like a hardcore Web3 investor in my point of view, because I think like the real Web3 investors are more like protocol investors in layer one and layer twos. And I think they have a much more technical setup. So usually they hire software engineers and not financial people for due diligence, for example. But for us, and that's also the category that many other VCs in the Web3 space rather qualify for. I would say we were more like Web 2.5, because we invest rather in traditional business models around SaaS or marketplaces, or infrastructure plays, but that have a clear focus on Web3 related technology. And I think that's something that really well reflects in our portfolio. So first company we invested in 2020 was, for example, a company called Venly. It's a huge player by now and the wallet infrastructure for like games and games publishers. I think they have more 2 or 3 million users, but invested in marketplaces for trading bots.
Yeah.
invested in NFT white label platforms or infrastructure. And we also have a few gaming investments that we recently made. Yeah, that's our clear focus. Check sizes are 100 to 250,000. I've built up my own investment team over the time. So now it's a core team of four people. Yeah. We raised actually our first fund. We will announce this shortly in January. And it's different name, but a slightly adjusted name, but basically same thing as always. Okay. Check sizes go up a bit, will be 250k, and probably invest up to 10 to 15 startups per year, so slightly more. So basically, whatever we enjoyed the most the last few years, just more and faster and hopefully bigger. Yeah, that will be the journey moving forward.
Very nice intro. Thank you so much. You also talked a lot about a product market fit and how you are also helping companies to find that.
I think the question is always, what's the value that investors like add to companies they invest in, right? It's like, that's a generic, the overarching question here. I think, so first of all, of course, it's the capital that they provide. It's in order for the company to grow faster. So of course, a pre-seed and seed startup will raise a certain amount of money. So if it's pre-seed, maybe it's anything between 250k and 1 million, and if it's a seed, these are German numbers, and in American markets, everything's a bit bigger. But like in Germany, it's maybe 1 to 5 million for a seed, right? And so of course, the capital that you provide, number one. I think number two, it's the branding that is you associate with. Branding stands for, of course, what's your reputation? So I think venture capital is, it's also a people business. So we build up relationships with people that we co-invest alongside with, and then the founders that we are backing, or the teams that we are backing. Mm-hmm. And the name of a VC over time also is supposed to represent the quality of the team that's behind the investment team. Are we able to be better than others and like cherry picking like winners, like on average, for example? Mm-hmm. The other thing is, what's the reputation that we're building up with the founders that we've backed, like how much value that we have contributed? And that brings us then to the last part of what might that value actually be? I think that differs a bit from like investor to investor you're talking to, and also at which stage you're investing. So for us, we are focused on pre-seed and seed. But there are others, for example, who are like growth investors who do like a Series A or B, or like a different part of the life stage of the company. We try to be as early as possible. So 6 to 18 months after companies are founded, these are usually the companies that we see in our funnel.
Yeah.
And for us, the key challenge in this life stage is, as you already mentioned, this product market fit. So I would always say that if you talk to us of how we look at your life stage as your business, we would always say for us, it seems like the holy, like the end boss, so to speak, for a huge milestone to reach is a product market fit. Because from all the companies that we see to 12 months after they're funded, 60, 70, 80% of them will die because they do not manage to achieve something around product market fit. And then they cannot keep raising capital like from bigger investors.
Yeah.
So the value that we try to add is mostly not just try to be like really rigorous of the companies that we look at, what's the likelihood or chance that they're on a good way, like they're on the right track. Timing seems ideal. The market makes sense. There's already early signs of competition, which can also be a good sign that we think the team has the experience or the personality traits that we think are required to really pull this off. So that's a lot of time that we spend on that can then help a company if we're convinced. And the more we try to dig ourselves into what they're doing, the more we're also able to talk to other investors and explain to them as well why we believe in the theme. So of course we can help them fundraising in that sense, bringing along, for example, co-investors.
Yeah.
But the other side is also just to steelman them like almost like a close advisor. So it's not standardized because it depends on startup to startup. Not everyone struggles as much with being on the right track. Some companies need 2 or 3 iterations. For some, it's faster than expected. And sometimes the teams bring different strengths and weaknesses, or sometimes they require a certain like support that others might not. So for us, it's more like we see ourselves as an extension to the team, that they can trust us and that they can partner with us, and that we try everything we can do in terms of we look at the market and what we see with other companies to help our founders to get on the right track to the timing, but we also like how the market looks like and give them feedback on that. And but sometimes it can also be a little bit more hands-on. So that really varies, to be honest, from case to case.
Okay, interesting. How do you measure success initially, especially what are the factors you care for when you make an investment decision?
I think so we do pre-seed and seed. Say pre-seed is even more about the founders, because pre-seed means that there's often not even a product yet or not even an MVP yet. So like sometimes literally like pre-product, just a pitch deck, an idea, like a founding team. And if it's seed, so I think that the more it continues in its growth like life stage, the more it becomes about traction, the more it becomes about like a KPI or number driven approach. So we also do seed investments. So here it's often, then the focus is much more even on product go-to-market strategy. Yeah. So they might already have some sort of prototype. They might already have a feeling for some customers they're talking to. And then we basically try to get an understanding of how well do they know they think needs their product and how close in communications are they with them.
Yeah.
I think describing how to make investment decisions, this is craftsmanship, right? This is an individual philosophy. Like, depending on who you ask, everyone might give you a little bit of a different answer. So there's no standardized blueprint for this. Our perspective on it is, though, it's how we try to look through our lenses, is it's much harder to predict what's successful, I think, than it is to find certainty about things that you think are not going to work. At least that's how I try to look at many investments. So I try to work almost more like red flag principle. So it's, you give me a certain amount of hours to spend some time with an idea and with a team, and I just need to find one red flag. So I just need to find one counterpoint that to me seems strong enough that I have the conviction this is not the right setup. I think that's for me easier actually to find an investment. So it's like, you give me, I don't know, 30, 40, 50, 60 hours to spend my mind around an idea, and I have to come up with all kinds of tools or thoughts I have to find fragility and try to crack it. And if I can't, of course, it's uncertainty, right? So we're not expecting perfect answers and everything. It's more like, for example, if you talk about personalities of founders, it's like, what's the degree of intellectual honesty, something we really care about? So, you know, they're in this hostile environment of pre-product market fit. They try, everyone will tell them it's a shitty idea in the first place. This is how early stage founding works. Most people don't know this because they never experienced it from the founder side.
Yeah.
So it requires a lot of grit and resilience and try and error. And then, for example, we think, it's just one example of many, we think intellectual honesty is really important. So when I talk to a founder and I confront them with some maybe inconvenient truth or some observations that I have, that they immediately, they don't stay within their intellectual comfort zone of, oh, I don't want to hear this or don't want to know. They take whatever you say and they try to immediately either find a good response to, and maybe that's something that I can learn, something I didn't know, or they have some data that they can back it up with, or sometimes they even change a little bit their perspective if it makes sense.
Okay.
So I think you want to have founders, for example, who can be incredibly stubborn, but are incredibly open-minded at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's quite rare, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So this is just one viewpoint on founders, right? And then there's many more. There's market, there's timing, there's, do they have the right skill sets to bring? If it's, I don't know, like a B2B finance solution that they're trying to work on, then, you know, it makes probably sense if they have a few years of industry experience, because if they have to deal with like corporate customers, then probably better they come from that industry. But if they build a DeFi protocol, not necessarily. So again, that depends on a case by case.
Okay, I see. Yeah, maybe let's talk about any investment decisions where you also learned a good portion, any special learnings you came up with that you wish you had earlier when you started. It can be good or bad.
Yeah, I think society has a pretty unhealthy view on startups. I think that there is, like, to me, I would always say, like, for me, entrepreneurs are like the heroes of the society. Like, I have a very almost political, like, emotional view on this, because I just know from first hand experience, like, one, how important innovation is, because everything that we experience in terms of like prosperity is because there has been some sort of innovation at some point of time that was pushed by someone, right? And the second of how much sacrifice and failure it requires to, and like get up again and try and like iterate like continuously to get to the point where innovation actually is made. And innovation is incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And I think as a society, we only used to see like the results, the outcomes of great companies. And just the fact that once most people hear about companies and they know that, oh, it's a unicorn or it has made an IPO or whatever, like I think the first reality check is always just go on Crunchbase and just check when this company was founded. And almost every single case we realize a company from being born to having an IPO, that what sometimes seems like an overnight success or idealized through movies or media, like it's been 10 to 15 years of like hard work.
Crazy.
And lots of failures along the way. So it's often founders who try it a second, the third time, I don't know, made lots of personal sacrifices, because having worked for years and years, for 80 to 100 hours a week, it puts like pressure on their relationships or on their families, or on their like social lives. So in a way, it's, I think, even so extreme that I would say I think the best founders to meet seems, or many great founders I've encountered, I feel like they have a lot of drive, and I always wonder, like, where does the drive come from? So it almost brings me as far to think that it probably comes from shitty experiences somewhere in their childhood. Because, you know, what normal person that's not insane, if you look at it very just pragmatically, would be willing to put so much individual risk and so much hard work on like individual ideas to stay on them for so many years, right? I think you could always argue like a normal person that wants to have a like balanced life with like work-life balance and so forth, like it's not the right job.
Yeah.
So what I see in society is I sometimes worry a little bit almost that it gets over-idolized, but just the bright parts. And I think no one really likes to talk about how hard it is. I think that's unfortunate because everyone who's failing, and again, that's the overwhelming majority, like they don't really talk about the failures because it's not really appreciated by society, I think. But people forget this. Like I always would compare this to a scientist who is in a lab somewhere and does like drug research. Like how many like hundreds and thousands of trials has it taken before someone invents penicillin, or like someone invents like some, I don't know, like some other drugs. And I think appreciate the failure like cycles of the iteration that's required to reach innovations, then that's, it's just creating like a little bit of a reality distortion. So I think that's what I want to tell everyone. Like just look at the early stage success stories of these companies that today is unicorns. Like they all struggle. And this, and but the good thing is, there's so much content on all of that. Just pick any company you're interested in that's a unicorn today. Just dive a little bit deeper and just see what did they actually do 10 years ago when they got started? And what's the stories that they have to share that I can learn from today?
Do you have any interesting technology insights that you want to share? Or
yes, lots to talk about. If you're an investor, I think what's interesting is that, especially if you do early stage, that you see basically cutting edge stuff the whole day, because the companies that we see now deal flows is like the next like wave of emerging businesses of the next like 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years, right? Because we see what people are building on today before most people, until most, like whatever that is being built on right now that will succeed, people will know about this in a few years down the line.
Yeah.
So we're very like early in observing what's being built. Like we're very, basically we're like standing next to a lab and are able to watch all the scientists speak through the early experiments. I think what, I mean, apart from Web3, maybe what I found interesting is this recent progress of the OpenAI chatbots. I think this has, again, put like some focus on like how beautiful or like disruptive like certain innovations can be. I think this will be really interesting down the line in terms of just like hundreds of thousands of use cases that would be built on this. But within our Web3 ecosystem, I think we have seen a lot of shifts the last 12 to 16 months to more NFT-related use cases. I think everyone is hungry right now for like sustainable use cases built with like NFTs. I think, so I was personally not like a huge fan of most of these art or brand-related NFT collections in the last 12 months, because to me it always seems that like there has been a lack of substance. Like because we come back to product market fit, right? It's about people need to use this sustainably. And I think when the motivation is largely around making money, then like if it's only about money, it's a Ponzi scheme. Like that's a problem. So it's only sustainable if there's really use cases that come with it that will be used by some people at some point who do not make care about the money making part, and they don't even know what the technology really does. I think what we see is that there's a lot of infrastructure being built in this space. There's also like a lot of regulatory like frameworks or like changes being made right now, so I think this can become really interesting. And then again, it's about the promise of the technology, right? So I think it's about, it's basically just like about IP-related use cases and issues. And we see a lot of cool companies the last few months that try to build use cases for people to make it easier to monetize their assets, or to, or for example, gaming is something I'm actually very excited about, because I think sometimes people ask about if digital assets make sense or not. Like I would always tell them, that question was answered 15 years ago with gaming. That's a done deal. Like we do not need to argue about if virtual assets are relevant or not. They are, period. And and that's something that like companies like Rockstar Games develops GTA, right? Like the last GTA is out since 10 years. Everyone is waiting for the next one. I think they make $1 billion in revenue every year since then, year by year. And I think this is 80% plus in-game purchases. So it's a huge market. It's a $1 billion market already.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with blockchain technology yet though. And I think it will be interesting for gaming, because I think building like IP rights that are digital to me seem much easier than if they're offline because there's more friction. So having in-game assets and just put them on NFT and you can trade them, and then you have like maybe engagement with brands at the same time, or use it as fan token. Or I'm excited about creator economies. So I think in gaming, for example, we also see this more and more, that like what YouTube did with entertainment. So yeah. 20 years ago, we need to watch TV if you want to be entertained. And if you want to be like an influencer, that term didn't exist yet, you need to be in TV, basically. You need to be on TV and radio. So you have this oligopoly of like media companies.
Definitely.
And then you have the right technology, which is in this case, YouTube or Twitch, that just give you the tools that you can be anyone. I mean, like you and me just need to have a camera and a computer and we can create content. And you can see this in the influencer space. There's this whole industry that emerged out of nothing with, I would argue, some of the most famous and wealthy influencers today were just pretty normal people. They came somewhere from the countryside area in Germany or US or wherever, and just focus on like a tiny niche, and then over time build up their own celebrity status because they have millions of followers, and people who just play games the whole day and others watch them, and they became millionaires by that. So I think the same industry could exist for game content, that people create assets in video games and then make money by selling them. But there has not been really the tools for that yet.
Yeah.
And I think with crypto, maybe it's the right timing to that it would work, because suddenly you can create an asset, you put it on an NFT, and you just put it out on a certain platform. And once games start accepting a certain NFT standard with like in-game assets, then you can create like complete creator economy based gaming economies, for example. So I think there's a lot of room for interesting use cases next 2 or 3 years. Let's see which one comes first.
How do you see the current bear market, and especially also with the FTX collapse? Do you think the industry is damaged for long, or do you see it recover soon, or doesn't it maybe even have, in your opinion, an impact?
It surely will have its impact, yes, of course. How exactly will be seen? I think the crypto market right now is nothing short of being described as a total shit show. I think that's how an outside observer would especially describe it. But I think it's really important to differentiate the fundamentals here. So FTX was like a centralized provider, right? It was basically like a bank, but for crypto, without having the regulation of being a bank. But it was also in the Bahamas, so it was also in a less regulated environment. And I think the idea of what they messed up, and the same, by the way, to my knowledge, holds also true to what Celsius did. With Luna, it's a different debate. I think it's a bit more nuanced. But like with Celsius, the same approach, like basically just mismanaged customer funds and leveraged them in a way that was not sustainable. It's like I'm the bank, you give me money, and I just gamble away your money, and then the whole system collapses. So that has nothing to do with the technology.
Definitely.
So the issue here actually, it's interesting because it's actually a point for the technology, because the whole technology is based on the original promise, which is decentralization. So the idea is that everyone should be in charge of their own coins. So with FTX or with other centralized providers, I give away my keys to my coins, so someone else has the custody. So if they mess it up, they're gone. Like, I don't have control over them. And I think there's this debate about convenience versus like security. And a lot of people, they prefer convenience, but they underestimate that convenience has its price. And I think now it has become painfully clear. And also, I think the market is just really overheated. So I think the problem is, if you look at technology, that there's always like these hype cycles of technology. And I think, so I try to think a lot about how, like, it's really complex to describe this on a psychological level, how it exactly works. But my like observation is, technology breakthrough in terms of promises of what you can suddenly do now. I think it's the same we can observe with the AI and the open AI and like the chatbots. Wow, suddenly you have this aha moment, or metaverse with virtual reality glasses, like wow, like first time experience. But then I think most people are not really good in innovation, and they don't really understand. Innovation is hard for everyone, right? But most people don't understand it at all, or they also lack the passion to really care.
Okay.
And I think what they usually care is then more the momentum and the, maybe the money, or the promises of the money that can be made with it. And then to me, it often seems like there's like this blurriness of, everyone knows that, oh, there's like a new technology, but very few people actually have an understanding of what that means. And then you have these hype cycles of, everyone kind of tells everyone like, oh, this is something that you can do. And then you have to first like also, there's different types of entrepreneurs who do this. There's clearly scammy ones who don't even care, who just want to cash in on the opportunity, and it's very unsustainable. So I think they're the most toxic one for the system. But then there's also the ones who don't know better, which is really naive, and maybe don't have, as I described before, like high intellectual honesty. So they're just in for the ride, or because everyone just talked about it, or it's like right now you know, in trend to be an entrepreneur, or whatever, and for the wrong reasons. And then they don't even know what they don't know. And then they also contribute to this negatively, but attentions at least are good, let's say. And I think this compilation of like different types of people coming to the system, like fires up the expectation of what everyone now thinks, and everyone stays in their own bubble and reconfirms and reassures themselves each other like the whole day. And I think this only works if there's a sustainable demand that kind of grows at the same time. So these new use cases, new customers coming in, people spending money. And if that doesn't happen at the same rate, it always implodes at a certain time. So it's like expectations are building up. And then after some time, it implodes because this reality check is like, ah, actually, no, no one is even as closely as using it as we thought they are. And then the market collapses. So the bright side is, though, at least that's my view on it. Let's see where we are in 2 or 3 years. I'm also dependent on the developments here. We think it's a correction period. So it means it's a reality check. It's like actually really like everyone struggles right now, like much more than before.
Definitely.
And only the things that are more sustainable will survive, and everything else will be just squeezed out of the market and needs to do something new or something else or something different. But yeah, I think that's what we're observing right now. Definitely. Probably for 2023 as well.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you on how long do you think this is gonna take?
It's like the general macro environment is not great. So it's like a total recession. Look at Meta shares. I think they also plunged down 70 or 80%, right? The last 12 to 18 months. And this is like one of the top five or top 10 like tech companies in the world. So it's not like that with certain size or existing business model from the past that this is a guarantee for stability. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of economic instability like globally. I don't know for Bitcoin. I think this, the question or like what makes a debate simple with Bitcoin is it's just purely demand driven, right? Because supply is fixed and the use case is very simple. I think it's just a monetary storage system. And like 20% of the global financial system is retail, like more or less, and 80% is institutional. So that means that the big bucks like that start causing movement is not retail investor, it's institutional investor. So the question is, when and how will they try to enter the space on a bigger level? And I think there could be some unexpected surprises, and I have no idea how this will play out. So I'm really clueless here too. But for example, I just read recently, like a few days ago, that I think the Russian president somewhere said that, that the government should support Bitcoin as a global currency. I think he mentioned it somewhere because they have a lot of sanctions, right, from the rest of the world. So I don't know, two or three bigger governments like make a move to just buy some Bitcoin. If a government moves a little bit of the treasury, like it spikes up price like quite easily.
Definitely.
But when and how that happens, no idea. Also no idea what happens if they do that, because maybe that means if Russia does it, maybe that's bad for Bitcoin from a regulatory standpoint, because then everyone else says it's a problem. I have no idea. But so these are independent. And then I think Ethereum, for example. So here's another thing. I think many people don't know who are not closer to the startup ecosystem. The Ethereum, like the Bitcoin value is very simple explained, but for Ethereum, the price ideally in an efficient market, the price reflects utility with the entire network, right? Because with Ether token, you have access and you can use the ecosystem. That's what the value means. And I think almost half of all the tokens, of the thousands and thousands of tokens you can find that are listed on some exchanges, they are running on Ethereum. So that means that the more applications are being built on Ethereum or on Solana or other ecosystems that actually drive hundreds and hundreds of thousands of users to use them for whatever use case they're building, that drives up the value. So you could almost look at Ethereum like a, it's almost, it's like a new kind of stock almost. Like if you own some of it, then the price goes up because everyone is using the underlying technology more and more. And I think right now, because there's a recession and there's like a crypto winter and there's like a correction, we need to see use cases first. So we should be more excited, less focused on price right now, but more focused on what's being built like on right now and what applications like make us excited. If we would know the next 2 years the price is locked, let's just assume there would be no change, what would we be excited about in this space? I think this will be the question for the next 12 to 24 months. And if we find good answers to that, that attract hundreds and hundreds of thousands of new or millions of people that have not been part of the ecosystem before as users, that will like, that could then trigger the next run for a price increase again.
Definitely. It's also interesting how Reddit, how Meta, how Instagram, how Starbucks are using this Trojan horse of loyalty systems to introduce NFTs to the masses. What's your take on that?
I'm actually quite skeptical about corporations in general, but this is just my personal opinion. I'm heavily biased because I'm on the VC side, but I feel like the highest degree of innovation, I think, is early stage startups. Yeah. And I think the more you're apart from being an early stage startup, the less innovative you are. So in my experience, most big companies, and no disrespect to anyone, but I often have the feeling they don't really know what they're doing. I feel like I think often they're part of the problem of this like hype creation, that they also think that there's, oh, like this sort of technology is promising. And everyone is kind of, oh yeah, sure, let's try it out. But I think often these decisions are made by management and it's a top-down approach. I don't know, like some, I've witnessed this many times from startups that interacted. Sometimes they also have corporate clients and sometimes it's like, oh, the upper management was in an event or a conference. They're excited about some technology and they just push it down to like three levels down to the middle management. Okay, you guys make it happen. Yeah. And then they don't know what they're doing. So it's like, and the problem is that's not sustainable. Like, you know, so for example, all these brands that try to enter the metaverse right now, it's, I don't know what the fuck they're doing, to be honest. Because I consider myself a hardcore gamer. I think I'm like top 2% early adopter when it comes to technology. The first one, my friendship circle gets the Oculus since more than a year and tried all the games. Like,
cool.
I don't know what the hell is that. I don't know what the hell these corporates think they're doing in the metaverse. Everyone who's super excited about the metaverse and think this is a groundbreaking innovation, doesn't know that video games exist since 20 years.
Yeah.
So I would always tell people, look into gaming and then look into metaverse, because that's just my take on it. Mm-hmm. I would argue metaverse is more like an evolution to, I think it's an evolution to it. If there would have been not been any gaming since 20 years, there wouldn't be any discussions on metaverse. True. Because all the graphics engine, all these devices and the technology is so much based on what has been developed in gaming since 20 years. And if you play GTA online with your friends, you can play, I would argue GTA 5 is its own metaverse.
Definitely.
Based on these
Yeah, I also talked to someone who played this game or metaverse in 2000. Oh, I forgot its name, but I think it's Second Life.
Second Life.
Second Life. He also,
of course.
He also met his or her wife through Second Life, and they now have children. Yeah, it's funny how things evolve and what you can do with it. But maybe
absolutely. Yeah.
Before we wrap things up, what's your advice for founders, and what do you think, following your presentation at NBX Berlin? I think you said try to bootstrap as long as possible and don't give up, and it's difficult, product market fit and so on. Maybe you can give out some advice for founders who are struggling, who, what should they do and so on. What's your take on that? In general,
like I said, it's extremely hard to be an early stage founder. So always keep in mind that there's nothing harder when it comes to innovation and in business than being there. And I think most people, they don't know, and most people, they don't appreciate or respect that. And I think don't like on your darker days, especially when you're in trouble, like just go to the companies that you think are the most successful ones, and just look into the early founder days.
Yeah,
and look at the stories that they tell, because I think this is really uplifting, and you will like really realize you're not alone with the struggles that you might have. And the third thing is this is an easy saying. Y Combinator also says this all the time. I think they're really obsessed with product market. This is a really great source of learning here.
Yeah.
But they also, I think they're also the one who said, be in love with the problem that you try to solve and not so much about the product.
Yeah.
On a daily basis, if it wears down on you emotionally, it's like, how much does the problem that you try to solve really drive and bother you? Is it really worth all the struggle? So don't do it for lifestyle or like reputational like reasons. I think a lot of people, they do this, oh, I don't really know what to do, oh, that's probably being a founder.
Yeah.
No, I think the best founders, they really have some problem that they identify, be like, okay, I'm going to solve this.
Yeah, I just watched a video of Michael Seibel today as well there, where he said it, most people, they lose motivation over time. They go into a market where they're not very passionate about the problem. And yeah, I think it's a roller coaster. It's taking time, and yeah, the most important thing is, believe into it and have maybe a team that you love working with, because I think that's also like a struggle or difficulty for many startups where they have a hiccup along the way with their founders and then it's difficult to continue. Is there something you want to say before we wrap things up?
I think so far so good. Yeah. Who are building on exciting use case ventures, like feel free to reach out to us. Like I said, we do pre-seed and seed, 250k tickets. We invest globally, so we're not restricted to Germany or Europe. And yeah, I think if you talk to other VCs, this is just my take on it. I think the best VCs, they are passionate about innovation.
Yeah.
I think in the end of the day, that's what it boils down to. And as a founder, don't be afraid to approach VCs. If you're really passionate for what you're doing and you have a lot of knowledge, understanding of what you're building,
yeah,
of the market, if you meet someone who is on the VC side who's actually passionate about innovation, they will love talking to you, because it's every smart or every great founder I talk to, this, I always go out of conversation learning something new.
Okay.
And if I love that as part of my job, which I do, then it's nothing better that I could imagine. So don't mind approach VCs even early, even if you don't fundraise right now.
Okay.
Sometimes it makes sense, especially early stage. You can just start and bootstrap and just openly reach out and be like, hey, not fundraising yet, but building something. Is it interesting to you? And then just see wherever the conversation develops, depending on who you talk to, what relationship you can build.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Ben. I love talking to you, and I'll let you know when I share this. Thanks.
Sure. Sounds good.